Morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Brian Kennedy from the Office of Public Defender in Fairfax. I reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Can I ask a quick question, please?
Yes.
One of your assignments of error is that the trial court erred because it didn't set aside it because of impermissible extrinsic evidence that the jury heard. What was extrinsic? What evidence was extrinsic?
Yes, Your Honor. And in terms of both assignments 4 and 5, that's really the crux of the question, I think. If the court finds it to be extrinsic, then it was error not to investigate it at the lower standard of proof. And if the court finds it not to be extrinsic, the court would not agree with it. It's extrinsic because had the Commonwealth sought to introduce the exact same evidence, the Commonwealth had sought to go up to the laptop while it was playing in open court and change the sound settings.
Well, now, hold on. I thought extrinsic meant the jury considered something that was not in evidence.
Correct.
Well, the recording was in evidence.
Not the sound recording that the jury played to itself in the jury room. That was not in evidence in the same way.
Was the information that was on the recording played in the course of the trial?
The recording was played during the course of the trial.
Okay, and everyone heard or did not hear it based upon their observations as to how they want to consider evidence in the course of the trial. And the concerning thing that Judge Haley has and that I have is that when you think of extrinsic or extraneous evidence, you're thinking about something that's outside of the presentation of the evidence. In other words, there was a document that was considered that should not have been considered. There was a piece of evidence that somehow made it back to the jury deliberation room that should not have made it back. From what I understand, the concern is that what all they did was turn up the volume so that they could hear it. How does that make it extrinsic or extraneous?
Well, I would disagree with the characterization of the court that all they did was turn up the volume. What is clear from the record that we do have, and I admit it's a little bit of a record because we didn't have the investigation and summons of the juror, mm-hmm. is that by manipulating the sound settings, they were able to hear what they believed to be one person talking to the elimination of the other person talking, and then vice versa, because there were two people talking over each other on the sound recording. And the only reason a jury would have done that is if they were having difficulty hearing when the two people are talking over each other.
Well, let me ask you this. My wife says maybe I ought to get a hearing aid. She might be right. She's right about most things. But suppose I'm a juror and my hearing aid dies. And I say, I can't hear what they're saying on this recording. Will you turn up the volume? And they do. Would that be somehow extrinsic evidence when they turn up the volume?
No. I think the easiest way I've conceptualized it is by comparing it to a picture, and the Commonwealth did that in their brief. I cited some similar cases. Using a magnifying glass in the case law is permissible. I think if the Commonwealth's using an Elmo, or defense is using an Elmo, and you zoom in on a portion of a picture that's been admitted to evidence, that would be permissible. This is not like that. That would be turning up or down the volume as a whole, the master control up or down. How do you hear the same exhibit? And this would be more like if the Commonwealth sought to say, well, I've admitted this picture, Commonwealth 1. Now, with no other foundation, let me introduce this enhanced photograph that makes it clearer so we can see the person's face. That's what this is, and that would require a separate foundation if that were done in a photograph.
How would they blow up the picture?
Enhance the picture with computer evidence. It'd be on a sound recording, for example, if there was a sound
well,
recording.
But no, my question is, we have a photograph, you say, the Commonwealth has introduced, and somehow they blow it up to a size that the Commonwealth hadn't introduced. Is that what happened here?
No, it's not what happened here. What the jury heard, what the jury believed they heard, was fundamentally changed because it became what the jury thought easier or more easier is the only reason you do this.
Hold on. What they heard was exactly was what was on the recording that was introduced in evidence, wasn't it? Exactly the same.
I would disagree with that because...
Well, are you saying there were words spoken on the recording in the jury room that were less or more than the words that were played in the courtroom?
The jury may have believed that they were able to hear words when they manipulated the sound settings, that they were unable to hear when the exhibit was played before them in the courtroom.
Well, but the words were there in any event, were they not?
They may have been. We don't know because we weren't able to ask a juror about that.
Well, are you suggesting that the words on the recording in the courtroom were different than the words on the recording in the jury room?
They may have been, and even if they weren't, this is where I think Brittle was instructed. Because Brittle, the Supreme Court, found that even if the pictures, which were not admitted to evidence, and it was an absurd amount of pictures that went back, which is obviously different in this case, but both parties seemed to say in Brittle, and the Supreme Court seemed to rely on the fact that most of the pictures were either wholly irrelevant that went back to any issue of the case, or were pictures of things that had been admitted into evidence from a different angle. And the Supreme Court still found that to be error, because the Supreme Court said there's lots of different reasons why someone might look at something from a different angle or a different perspective.
Suppose, taking Judge Haley's point a little bit further, counsel, suppose we're talking about a case where the instrumentality of death was a hammer, okay? And this is not this case, so I'm setting up a different hypothetical. The instrumentality of death is a hammer. And the question is whether or not this particular instrumentality or tool could actually be used to hit someone in the head to cause injury or death. And let's say that for the purpose of my discussion, this hammer was not published to the jury. In other words, they didn't get to hold it, didn't get to touch it, didn't get to feel it. They just knew that a hammer came into evidence. All right. And so they go back to the jury room and they start deliberating. And they've got the hammer in the back. And someone picks up the hammer and says, "Whoa, I didn't realize this thing was so heavy. This is heavy." Couldn't they do that?
Yes.
Okay, so what's the difference in turning up the volume so that they can get a full appreciation of the piece of evidence that is admissible and is appropriately considered?
If the jury were to use, someone had a cell phone back there, and there was some cell phone app.
But they didn't bring anything extra. That's a little different. They're bringing something extraneous into the process. That's obviously wrong. Someone has a cell phone, they call up someone, or they say, "I got a friend who's an expert in this, I'm going to talk to them." Bad stuff. Obviously, you can't do that. But I think the point that Judge Haley is making and the point that I'm trying to make is that they have the evidence and it's appropriately considered because it's been admitted. And then they only facilitate their observation or deliberation or use of this piece of evidence by taking advantage of something that is part of the evidence itself.
And if in the hammer example, they're looking at the whole hammer, which is in evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Here, they were dissecting the exhibit in a way that was improper because they were using an electronic means in the computer to dissect the exhibit in a way that the Commonwealth did not admit to evidence. And in that way, it's an extreme piece of evidence because, again, if the Commonwealth sought to do the same thing during its case in chief, and the Commonwealth sought to walk up in the well of the court and eliminate one voice by turning down the sound, that would have been objected to as not having sufficient foundation.
So you're saying that if the evidence had been admitted like it was, and say the Commonwealth decided as part of its closing argument to use it as a demonstrative exhibit for purposes of the closing argument, now it's in, so it's a little bit better demonstrative exhibit, and they turn up the volume during the course of their closing argument, they couldn't do that.
They could turn up the volume, but they could not manipulate the volume settings to do what they purport to be eliminating one voice and only playing the other.
Well, that's redaction or extraction. That's a little bit something different.
And that's what the jury did.
Okay. Why don't you move to your other argument, counsel?
We've
beaten you up pretty good on this one.
I think my points are clear.
Yes, sir.
In terms of assignment point, of course, for a man, because the court erred in finding that Mr. Ramshire was at liberty in this case. And 53.1.151's definition of at liberty has two clauses and a unique statutory construction that's critical in this case. The first clause really defines at liberty. At liberty is freedom without any legal restraint. That's really the definition of at liberty. That's what that means. The second clause, but shall also include, and then the list of things, including the phrase probation or parole, are exceptions to the general rule. Anytime we have a broad rule and then exceptions to it, those exceptions would be construed narrowly in just statutory construction. And that goes against what the Commonwealth's arguing, which is that this is an illustrative list. And like many other statutes, there's a broad definition followed by the word includes and then a list. That is a broad illustrative list. But here it's exceptions to the general rule.
What does Code Section 1-218, how does it define includes?
It's that we would read it includes but not limited to.
Why is that section not applicable
because
to 53.1151?
There are two instances of the word includes in 153.1 and 151. And I think in the first clause, it might very well be read includes but it's not limited to. because it would be includes freedom without any legal restraint. But it's not limited to that because of the exceptions found in the second portion of the statute. The second clause has, again, unique statutory construction. It's the only appearance of this construction in the code, which is but shall also include. And then it lists these exceptions. And reading them, because all of those exceptions are things that are not freedom without legal restraint, we can't read it to be this broad exemplar list. We're reading it as specific things that are not ordinarily within the scope of the definition that would then have to be narrowly construed and limited to the list. It's an exhaustive list.
Counsel, it seems to me like I understand where you're going with this. We've all done the same thing here, getting ready for today's proceeding. But really, you're trying to distinguish, it seems like, post-release supervision from actual, ultimately, probation. You know, give me your best shot at how you do that and how that you don't reach an absurd result.
Well, probation, parole, and post-release supervision are all separately defined in the code. And there's a reason that the General Assembly did that, presumably. The General Assembly uses three separate words or two separate words. They mean two separate things. There has to be meaning. For example, in the statute cited by the Commonwealth, 53.1145, the General Assembly, after 1995, amended that statute to put the same sentence in that code section, list probation, post-release supervision, and parole. So we know the General Assembly in another context, and there's another code section, 2.2221.1, both of which the General Assembly, after 1995, specifically inserted or wrote a statute using all three words. When they did not do so with 53.1151. Again, there has to be meaning behind that if the General Assembly decided to do it in one context and not the other. The reason, for example, parole is not applicable in this case is twofold. Obviously, Mr. Rancher was convicted after 1995, but also parole is not a meaningless term in the statute. Parole is importantly in there because we still have people on parole. There are people who were sentenced before 1995 who were parolees, and there are persons who were sentenced now who are still subject to parole because of the offense they was before 1995. And probation is different because it's governed by 192.303 and it's the sections following that. It's a trial court control, and the trial court's decision to place someone on post-release supervision versus probation is important, and there are different circumstances, different cases where a trial court would choose to move one or the other. That's because the conditions are different, the terms of revocation are different. So it's important that they have each. And I'll point out to the court in terms of an absurd result that post-release supervision is not the only status that would not be included in the statute. For example, if someone is convicted of a sex offense, they go to prison, they then go to sexually violent predators case. When they're released from the prison, their probation starts, but they may be confined in our civil commitment proceedings for an amount of time that their probation would run. When they're released on conditional release, they would then be out. They would not be free without legal restraint, but they would not fall into one of the exceptions that are listed in the second half of the statute. So there are multiple types of NGRI acquittees or another one, where there are multiple types of statuses that are not present in the second half of the statute that the General Assembly has specifically decided not to include in their definition of applicability.
So Counselor, you're into your rebuttal time. You can continue to argue, but I just want you to know. Sorry.
I'll rest with that time reserved by time.
Yes, sir.
Please the court. I am John Jones, and I represent the Commonwealth. We are asking the court to affirm Mr. Ramser's convictions, first because he was at liberty within the definition of 18.2-67.5.2, and as it brings in the definition from the parole statute, and because there was no extrinsic evidence, even if he was able to prove everything that he proffered to the trial court. There was nothing extrinsic about the evidence that the jury considered in that proffer. And so he wasn't entitled to further investigation or the trial. So on the issue of whether Ramser was at liberty within the meaning of the statute, I think that the court has already latched onto this idea that there is no language of exclusion in the definition provided by 53.1-151. It's an illustrative list, and that is ensured by Code Section 1-218's provision that includes means, includes but not limited to. That's dispositive. To the plain language of the text here, that means that where 53.1-151 defines at liberty, it says it includes but is not limited to freedom without restraint. It also includes but is not limited to release pending trial, and sentencing, and appeal, and parole, probation, and even escape. And it sets up this matrix of all these different conditions that are not free without legal restraints, but also all the way down the spectrum, including you're supposed to be in jail, but you have escaped. And the idea behind the recidivism statute is to punish more harshly cases where someone has committed one of a certain set of sex offenses, and then within a certain period of time after getting out of jail, does it again. My opposing counsel brought up some other conditions, including like SVP committees and NGRI acquittals where they may be still confined. I'd submit to the court that those are not excluded by the definition that's provided in 53.1-151. But to the extent that there is a question about whether that constitutes at liberty, that would be a fact question. Because, real simply, Ramster is trying to read an exclusive list, an exhaustive list, where there is simply an illustrative list. It's the Commonwealth's position that because of the myriad similarities between parole, probation, and post-release supervision, and because of the stated purpose that the General Assembly gave when they instituted post-release supervision as to fill the gap left when we got rid of parole, that as a matter of law, that it is at liberty within the meaning of 53.1-151. But even if it wasn't as a matter of law, it was sufficient to go to the jury as a fact question, and they obviously determined that it was at liberty. They had sufficient facts before them from the parole officer and from legal arguments that were given by counsel to determine what post-release supervision was. They were instructed on what at liberty encompassed, and they made the decision that he was at liberty.
Switch gears for me, counsel, and get to the other issue about this extrinsic evidence. And I provided a pretty tough hypothetical for your opponent colleague, and so I'm going to provide a tough one for you. Suppose in the context of the jury deliberation, there was a piece of evidence where it was some speculation as to the significance of this piece of evidence. And the evidence was presented, and obviously the jury could give whatever weight it decided to give to the evidence as instructed by the court. And let's suppose this piece of evidence is something that is not readily, you can't really see it, and so that actually affects its materiality. But suppose they go in the jury room, and one of the guys says, you know what, this kind of paper, I can hold this thing up to the light, and we can actually see what it says. And the rest of the jurors say, huh. And they all go over to the window, and they hold it up to the window, and the sun shines through it, and suddenly they can see things that were not visible in the context of the trial itself. Would that be appropriate?
Whether or not it's appropriate...
That's a good hypo, isn't it?
It is a good hypo. I believe that that would not be violative because it would not be coming from, it would not be extrinsic, Your Honor. It would be coming from outside of the courtroom. The only thing coming from outside of the courtroom in your hypo is the sunlight coming in the window, and obviously we don't have a bar on jurors using that to observe. It may be weird. It may be that's kind of what juries are able to do because we hold jury deliberations inviolable in Virginia. I have some cases on point on that. Rule 2:606 actually precludes jurors from testifying about what goes on in the jury room, except for when there are influences coming in improperly from outside the courtroom. So again, you'd be dealing with unadmitted exhibits. And like this situation in Evans where the defendant's uncle says to a juror outside the courtroom, boy, he's a real scumbag, he's a real slick guy, and I hope he gets everything that's coming to him.
Great family unit there, huh?
but obviously, obviously that's extrinsic. That's extrinsic. And then the situation with Brittle, again, you had, I think, 90 unadmitted photographs that went back to the jury room inadvertently. That's extrinsic. That was unadmitted evidence. But here what we have is a recording that was duly admitted, played back on a computer that both the Commonwealth and Defense Counsel agreed was a suitable means of playback. And the fact that the jury, as the trial court found, inspected the recording very closely, listened to it with great care, played with the volume setting so they could hear it better, that did not transform it into something that was not admitted, that did not transform it into something that was extrinsic evidence. And so Ramser was not, under those facts, entitled to either further investigation on that proffer or a new trial, even if he was able to bring those facts out.
I think we understand your argument, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. We'll just ask to...
Yes, sir. Counsel, you got about a minute and a half.
I understand, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
In terms of at liberty, no one who's on post-release supervision would say that they are at liberty, that they are free in a way that liberty intends. They would say that I have an officer who supervises me, I have conditions, I have many things that I have to do. So when we're really looking at what is the definition of at liberty, it really goes down to that, because it's the same thing for parolees, probationers, and everyone else listed. But they are, the second language, but shall also include, has to be limited, because it's not things that are encompassed in the general read. And the reason it's exclusive and not illustrative is because it doesn't just say includes, like every other statute in the code that is illustrative. It says definition includes only, then the list. Here it's includes not only, but shall also include. It has to mean something different. The General Assembly just meant it to intend people who are not incarcerated in prison. They could have just written, at liberty means persons who are not presently incarcerated in the Department of Corrections or another penal institution. They did not do that. There has to have been a reason for that. This court has to give, that meaning has to give this list meaning, and it's a meaning of exclusion. And because post-release supervision was physically not included after 1995,
thank you, counsel. Very good. We'll come down and greet counsel. The next case court will call in here is Commonwealth of Virginia and Nathaniel Howard Moore III.